Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. My next guest is Jonna Mendez. She's the author of In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Also co-author of The Moscow Rules and Argo, which everyone knows Argo. Jonna, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we have something, we have a connection, something in common. I know your husband was involved in Argo, which is your connection. And one of my best friends in the world is a gentleman named Rocky Sickman, who is one of the hostages in Iran.
I can only say it's a small world.
Yeah, how about that? I know his son was a part of that movie and really interesting. So, Jonna, this could not be more interesting, and I'm not going to get in your way. I would love it if you would just tell my audience your story, and we'll jump in where we need to.
Wow. Let's see. Do you have a couple of hours?
Yeah, we'll take all the time we need for you, Jonna.
Well, the idea for the book came when COVID hit, and like everyone, I got kind of locked down and was looking for a way to spend the time after I'd done maybe 26 jigsaw puzzles. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I'll write a memoir. I'll write the story of what it was like to be a woman in the CIA. We had covered Tony's career several times and several ways. Mm-hmm. But I thought it might be possible that that looking a little harder at a woman's path through the CIA might be interesting. I have to point out that the office that Tony and I both worked in was called Office of Technical Service. It was the technical arm of the intelligence community. It was very much like the Q in the James Bond movies. Wow. We were composed of chemists. We had physicists. We had electrical and mechanical engineers. We had people with specialties, technical specialties, so very narrow. I don't know where they would have worked had they not worked for us. Like one man who did nothing but batteries for his entire career. He was a genius at batteries. So that was the office that all of this was taking place in. That's the office that Argo came spinning out of. Mm-hmm. And then many other operations. So the story I tell is how I went to Europe from Wichita, Kansas, to be in my best friend's wedding. She married an American military officer. And they went away on a honeymoon, and there I was in Europe. And I didn't want to go back to Kansas. Mm-hmm. So I got a job in Frankfurt, Germany, working for a bank. It was a banking town with a lot of large American banks. Chase Manhattan was my bank of choice. And I met a group of young Americans, expatriates over there, started dating one of them. I married him about a year and a half later in Switzerland, only to find out that he worked for the CIA. So that's where the CIA thing kicks in, very early in the story, actually.
And Jonna, at that point, what did you know about or understand about the CIA before you found out your husband was a part of it?
Not much. Not much. He said, you know, you'll find it very interesting. I think you'll like the, there's a lot of travel involved. We'll be living in various places. We will be undercover most, if not all of the time. And I was, you know, I was young. I was, 20? It was sounded good to me.
And so you started as a contract wife. Can you explain what that is?
Well, it's kind of a euphemism for secretary in the field. Uh-huh. The officers who were assigned overseas, their wives would go with them, of course. They'd get there, and they needed administrative help in the office. So they would hire the wives. This was if you were overseas, this would happen. This didn't happen back here in the States. Mm-hmm. But back then, overseas, they wanted people that they could trust, and the wives were the category. So it was, we all came in as contract wives, as typists, as secretaries. Then when we went back, a permanent assignment back to the States, I was hired as a staff secretary. The fact was I never wanted to be a secretary at all. I had, you know, I had kind of some other ideas. But I started as a secretary and throughout my career of 27 years and throughout this book, I slowly worked myself up through various levels of this and that. And ended up being the chief of disguise at CIA, which was a wonderful.
that That is
wonderful.
Fantastic. Now, did you, obviously you did, but you just had sort of a natural talent for it, or is it something that you saw, okay, this is a lane I think I could work on?
No, I had no natural talent. I was trained to a fairly well. When I started as a secretary here in the States, I told them I was bored, I was going to leave. They said, take some of our photo courses. I did. I liked photography already a lot and kind of worked my way into a photo job overseas with my husband. And this was not, a log just tried to fall out of my fireplace. I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness.
It didn't make it, so we can keep talking.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. Let me reset, by the way, John, in case people are just tuning in, they're wondering what we're talking about. My guest here is Jonna Mendez. She's the author of In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. When she was about 20, over in Europe, met a young man, dated him, married him. He let her know he was a part of the CIA. She became a part of the CIA herself, and she's kind of walking us through her career. Please continue.
Sure. So I was doing some photo work and liking that very much. Taking a lot of training because the CIA trains you a lot. They put a lot of money into their employees, making sure they know what they're doing and how to do it well. I took a long trip for a summer. Then I have to be cagey. I can't say where I went. So I say I went to the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. And I spent a summer out there filling in for someone and just fell in love with that place. With that culture, with the food, with the music, with everything. I came back to Washington and I said, I would like an assignment there. And they said, there is no photo job opening up. There's going to be a disguise job in a couple of years. You could think about that. I said, yes, train me. I can be a disguise officer. I've been doing makeup since I was 5. How hard could it be? I thought. Well, silly me. It is hard. It's very complicated. It's very difficult to master all of the pieces of what you need to know to do disguise. But I did, and ended up taking that assignment in the subcontinent, and then began the rest of my career where I ended up moving up through disguise and ended up chief of disguise. You know, a lot of people think that disguise is just wigs and mustaches, and sometimes it is, but a lot of the time it's a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated than that. It's an interesting place to work.
Absolutely. So I'm sure you know one of the things, at least I'm going to ask, as a complete civilian who's never served the country a day, in the military or any sort of operations like this. I have some good friends in the FBI. I know a little more than the average bear about that. Nothing about the CIA, but movies and television and such. When you would partake in movies or television about the CIA, do you roll your eyes and laugh, or do you kind of chuckle and go, oh, they're pretty close?
You know, it's somewhere in the middle. I roll my eyes and sometimes I kind of growl because it's I think like anybody who has a profession or a hobby or something that they care about and know about. And then when you see it represented in the wrong way, it's irritating.
I see.
It's just like that's not right. I mean, if you're going to present it, you should present it correctly. Of course, if it's an entertainment, that's never the goal.
Right.
The goal of entertainment is to entertain people.
And I bet it gets under your skin because, as you well know, so many times in modern movies, the CIA, they're the bad guys. You know, it's always our country is working against our country, and it's a, you know, Mission Impossible kind of thing. And that always bothers me, and I wasn't even a part of the agency.
Well, you know, with the movie Argo, I have to say that even the CIA liked the movie Argo. Mm. It is possible that it's the only good movie that's ever been made about the agency.
Interesting.
It was a great story. It was a rescue. It was so clear cut. There wasn't really room for any of the bits and pieces that sometimes they sprinkle in. It was a good movie. about people, everybody doing the right thing. The people that Tony rescued are still around. I still, because we've lost Tony, but they stay in touch. He very possibly saved all of their lives, and they know it. Wow. And it's just a wonderful thing.
So, Jonna, what I think about, so I will turn 60 this year. And so at the time that you were doing this, was at the same time that so many other things were being invented. Music, rock and roll was being invented, and show business was being invented, and television and movies. And what you guys were doing with the agency, you really were like on the ground floor, sort of, weren't you?
Well, we were more or less. We were on the ground floor, but we were back behind the black curtain. It's almost like the magic industry. I think part of the fascination that people have with espionage is the fact that it takes place behind a wall.
Yeah.
Just like the magicians do. And by the way, I would point out that somewhere in the book, about two-thirds of the way through, I start describing how we worked with magic builders, with the magic community, with the people in LA who are creating deceptions and illusions. And we took some lessons in how to improve what we were doing. Wow. Interesting mix of people.
So in general, Jonna, when we talk about spies, like, oh yeah, so-and-so, yeah, I think he's a CIA guy. That person's a spy. The classic spy, those exist, right? I mean, I know they've been exaggerated and they've been, exploited, but spies very much exist.
Oh, they do in many forms. We were technical people. We were not out recruiting the foreigners who were going to betray their country to work for us. Uh-huh. That's a different category of CIA people. Uh-huh. Those are called case officers. And I think that when the general public is imagining what a spy might look like, sound like, work like, that's the group of people they have on their mind. This is the job that they have, I was just always in awe of how could you convince someone to betray their country. And, people do that for different reasons.
Sure.
But still, at the end of the conversation, they have to say, yes, I will work for you. I will work for you. I will give you secrets that your policymakers want and need in order to make good decisions.
Yeah.
So the people that we hired to do that job, the people that we hired to be case officers, that was a unique group of people. They had to be almost charismatic. You've met people like this.
Sure.
You meet them everywhere. When you meet them, you go, oh, I would really like to be friends with that person. That is a great person just to talk to. It's a very kind of president of the class. We couldn't teach people how to do this. We could teach them everything else. But we couldn't teach that piece of it, that interpersonal skill.
Boy, and
that everyone responds to.
You think about your discipline with disguise, and fast forward to 2024, and you can only imagine the kind of technology we have.
Well, I can and I can't, because I know they're not doing what we were doing back in the day, and that's why they let me talk about it.
Uh-huh.
It's obviously not classified anymore.
Right.
Like our use of masks for years and years and years, I would never, ever mention. After I retired, never mentioned masks. And then all of a sudden, well, it's okay. You can talk about that. So they're doing something different, or they're doing masks differently. I don't know what it is.
Do you enjoy the genre, Jonna, that most of us, will watch spy movies or Jason Bourne or Mission Impossible? Can you enjoy them? Do you gravitate toward it, or you kind of stay away from it?
I like some of it. I like the Bond movies because they're just so, they're just nuts. I mean, they're not meant to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
My son was crazy about the Bourne movies. He was a young, much younger, and that's what he liked. I liked The Americans a lot.
Mm.
I thought that TV show The Americans was just right on the nail. Really
it.
Good.
Hmm. That's so great. So we've been talking to Jonna Mendez. The book is In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Jonna, thank you so much for spending time with us today, and thank you for your service. It's really an amazing story.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you. This was fun.
Thank you, Jonna. All right, going to take a quick break. Be right back. DGS and KMOX.
You shouldn't have told me.
Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be interviewing actor D.B. Sweeney. He's taking part in the Puck Cancer Charity Game, which is going to take place Friday, April 5th, 7 p.m. at Centene Community Ice Center. The Blues alumni featuring Barrett Jackman, Pierre Turgeon, and coached by Hall of Famer Brett Hull, hosting a roster of NHL alumni and special celebrity guests, including Hall of Famers Ed Belfour, Chris Chelios, and country star Dierks Bentley, and, of course, D.B. Sweeney. So it's going to be for the Jimmy V Foundation for Siteman Cancer Center. So great cause, great fun.
Very cool event.
We get to talk to D.B. Sweeney.
Yeah. When you guys want, if you want to look into tickets, it's at Ticketmaster.com. So it's like $50 for normal general admission. And it's going to be at the Centene Community Center. It's not at Enterprise, just for everybody to be clear. And if you want to do the big deal, $500 gets you into like a all-inclusive area with all the former players and celebrities and all that used to hang out and eat and drink.
I mean, $500 is $500, but if you're a charity giver anyway,
yeah,
it's a pretty good way to spend $500.
Hang out with Holly and Chaser and all those guys. I mean, come on.
That's
those
great.
Guys, those guys know how to have fun.
Let's do some sports. So we talked about the Shohei Ohtani deal debacle pretty extensively. What else? I mean, other than the March Madness, what's going on with Cardinals? Anything?
Just, again, relatively normal. We're still waiting, though. We haven't gotten a new update on Lars Nootbaar to know if he's going to be ready for opening day yet. We know Edmund will not be. We know Sonny Gray will not be, but Sonny Gray might be like in the second series against San Diego or maybe the home opener.
That'd be great.
So it sounds like he's making good progress, but we're going to know more about him like today and tomorrow. I think it's either today or tomorrow he's going to throw against minor league hitters.
As guarded as like hockey?
Not as much, but yeah, like NFL has to declare. Like, in season, by the way, not in the off season, not in training camp, but they have to declare whenever. Well, actually, you know what? They do have to declare that in advance of, like, their preseason games. But, you know, in the NFL, you have to say, this is the injury. This is the likelihood that he plays, right? He's either probable, questionable, doubtful, or out. And they have to categorize. Baseball, barring an injured-less stint, you don't know if somebody's good to go, not good to go, and nobody's on the injured list yet because the season's not started.
Gotcha.
And they only do it now if they're trying to clear roster space. Like somebody's going to be out for 3 months, so put them on the long-term injured list, and you don't have to worry about to put them on the 60-day.
When do they do the, like, okay, thanks for your time in Jupiter. You're heading back to AAA.
Oh,
maybe we'll see you.
It's been happening gradually for the last week and a half, 2 weeks. So they sent, like, five or six more guys out today. They'll send another few out. So as they need fewer players for games, they send people out more.
Yeah.
But also, like, they can call them back. So if they're looking at a game, like, man, we're going to be short on pitching, so let's bring a couple of the guys from minor league camp, and they'll be the guys that pitch our extra innings for this one.
And I know, like, the thing where if you bring a guy up, sometimes they don't bring him up because they don't want to start his time.
Right.
Can you give a little explanation
of
that?
All right, so basically everything works on a six-year clock in baseball, right? So after 2 years... or if you it depends on how much you play, but it's between 2 and 3 years you can be eligible for arbitration, which just means you get to try to win a bigger salary, and you have the right to go before an arbitrator to decide whether your number or the team's number is more accurate, or you can settle somewhere in the middle. So if you play, there are things called super twos, but if you're in the top quarter of players with 2 years of service time, you're a super two, you get one extra year of arbitration. So what teams are often trying to do is avoid that.
Okay.
And they're trying to avoid, you know, for example, a guy reaching free agency sooner. Cause so 6 years is what it takes to get to free agency. And if they, but mostly teams are guarding against the super two stuff.
Okay.
So you get to a certain point in the year, that's no longer a concern. But see, what baseball did in the last CBA was they built in some incentives to not do that. So if you finish, like you have a guy that wins the Rookie of the Year. Say Mason Winn wins Rookie of the Year this year. The Cardinals will get basically an extra first-round pick because they didn't hold him back and they played him. So it's a little, you have a little more incentive now if you like a guy, you like Victor Scott II, there's a little more incentive now to say, yeah, you're right, you're good to go from the very beginning rather than waiting that period of time that they used to await to avoid getting to arbitration earlier.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, you hear baseball nerds talk about it in simple terms, but it's just a calendar. They got to work off a six-year calendar, and they're trying to make sure that they get the most bang for their buck. And it used to be that it would hurt players quite a bit.
Okay, D.B. Sweeney up next after the news.
Josie's on a vacation far away. Come around and talk it over.
So welcome back, guys. DJS and Camo X. Coming up on Friday, April 5th, is the Puck Cancer Charity Game I told you about a few minutes ago. Our Blues alumni, featuring Barrett Jackman, Pierre Turgeon, coached by Hully, will be taking on Chris Chelios, Ed Belfour, Dierks Bentley, D.B. Sweeney. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to a great foundation, Jimmy V Foundation for Siteman. Everyone's been touched by cancer at some point. D.B. Sweeney joins us now. D.B., it's a pleasure. You have a lot of fans in the room.
Oh, thanks, bud. Thanks for having me on.
Dude, you could have made Fire in the Sky and stopped, and we'd be super excited to talk to you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
It has to be like we're geeked out to talk to D.B. Sweeney, the actor we've watched over the decades. You got to be geeked out when you put the blades on and go out with these guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just anybody who's had a beer with Brett Hull knows that that's a bucket list item. So, I don't know if it's ever been singular.
No one has ever had a beer with, no, you're right. Let me introduce my buddy Kevin Wheeler. He's the 25-year sports guy here in St. Louis. Go ahead,
Kevin. We were just joking, DB, that part of the deal, if people want to do it for $500, they can get into the VIP event, which means you could have some food and some beers with Kelly Chase and with Brett Hull and guys like you, which is also kind of the fun part. And talk a bit about that. You know, having covered sports forever, all the sports guys love musicians, they love actors, they all want to be that. And I'm guessing it goes the other way, too.
Yeah, well, when I did The Cutting Edge, 30 years ago now, I guess even a little more than that, I was living in New York, and I grew up a Ranger fan. And I had been skating for about 6 weeks, learning to skate from scratch. And the Rangers put me on their old-timers. They still call them old-timers, not alumni at that point. And so they put me on their team, and I, like I said, skating for 6 weeks, and I played in a game against the Islanders old-timers in front of 3,000 people. And Pierre LaRouche said, keep your stick on the ice and go to the net. And I thought, that sounds like good advice. I don't know what I'm doing. And I scored 2 goals on deflections. And I thought, wow, I'm pretty good at this. And then in the locker room after, Pierre LaRouche is collecting money from all the Rangers. He bet the whole team he could score 2 goals off my stick.
So they just set you up nicely.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so anyway, it's just an illustration of like how the hockey world just embraced me because of that movie. And, I have so many friends. And so, to hear Kelly dealing with this and Tony Granato, it just seems like an easy thing to bring all the forces together and try to attack this problem.
Yeah, it's fascinating, too. I mean, they a lot of these alumni groups do great work. I've never been around one, though, DB, that does more for the community and more regularly for the community than the Blues. I mean, these guys, a lot of them still live here in town. Brett Hull obviously still works for the team. Chaser's been around forever, and obviously he's going through his fight with leukemia right now. And we all love those guys. And I'm guessing that when you guys get the call to do things like this, it's an easy yes, right? I mean, it's fun. It's a great cause. And obviously, you get to have them score goals off your stick.
Yeah, I mean, it's very serious what Kelly's dealing with and with Tony Granato and all the other people that are suffering with the various different cancers that we're trying to attack. But, this is such a great group of guys that it'll be fun and hopefully we raise a lot of money and awareness.
So walking through it a little bit, I mean, people, you mentioned Cutting Edge. I know a lot of people, Rachel's not here today. She's out sick. But when we mentioned you were coming on, that was the first movie she went to. Dave and I looked at each other and it was the Fire in the Sky because we're both big UFO guys. But I'm the baseball nerd in the room. And obviously you were Shoeless Joe in Eight Men Out. You mentioned coming up as a Rangers guy. Was hockey always a favorite sport for you? Were you more baseball, more football, or are you just kind of anything goes?
I'm a big sports fan in all areas, but definitely baseball was my number one. That was what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to go play for the Red Sox. I'm from Long Island, which is where Kari Yastrzemski's from. He was my favorite player. But I've always been a baseball fan first, but hockey second, and never played as a kid. So doing that movie was a great opportunity to learn.
DB, how did you get into acting? I'm always fascinated how jocks get into acting.
I was a senior in high school, and the theater teacher was also the English teacher, and I was a wise ass, and he sort of dared me to take my act up on stage, and he dared me in front of the whole class, so I couldn't say no, and I just did that play, and it was a great experience, but it was not like any kind of a thing I thought about doing again, and then when I got hurt in college, I went to Tulane University to try and play baseball down there, and I got injured and started thinking, well, maybe I'll check out acting again while I rehab.
Nice. I should have known. I should have known you're a good guy. I was a college baseball guy myself too, so I figured you were pretty smart by going that route. So, when you get the opportunity to do these, and I, you know, we're going to talk about a couple things because I know you're in a really big movie that's coming out here soon, Francis Ford Coppola movie, Megalopolis. But when you get out there and get to hang with these guys, what is the best part? Just the pre and the post. You know, like as an example, I got to do the Cardinals fantasy camp, the Legends camp, and the best part is the in-between games. The best part is hanging out in the clubhouse or going out to dinner with the guys and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my theory, my son played hockey for many years. He's 22 now. He's in college, but from the time he was very little, he went through that whole travel hockey experience.
Oh, okay.
We came down to St. Louis, and my theory about why hockey players are such good guys is because of all that time in the room. Like, it takes 30 minutes to get your stuff on and hang out and 20 minutes to get it off. Whereas playing baseball, you know, you grab your spikes, you grab your glove. It's kind of like being a tennis player. It's you against the pitcher. There's not really a lot of teamwork in baseball. It's pretty much an individual sport,
yep,
masquerading as a team sport. And unless you're a shortstop or a second baseman or a catcher, I guess. And so in hockey, what I was able to observe is that it's a very, you know, self-policing world. Like, you really can't be a jagoff and survive many rooms. So
true.
I think it's kind of fascinating that culture is so positive in creating good guys.
So, DB, we're real close to the same age. I'll be 60 in September, and I grew up here, grew up a Cardinals fan, but I was also, like, I knew every player on the Reds. I knew every player on the A's. What did St. Louis mean to you growing up as a Rangers and a Red Sox fan?
Well, I mean, growing up, I wasn't as aware of the Blues as I am now, or as I was, you know, from the 80s, 90s, and so forward. But the St. Louis Cardinals was just excellence. You know, I mean, they beat my Red Sox in 67, and they won again in 68, and or did the Tigers win in 68? Either way, they went to the World Series two times. But I got to, when they first had the Field of Dreams field built after that movie was made, I got to play in a game there, and I got to hit off of Bob Gibson, which was a huge thrill.
Jeez.
And it was amazing. And so, you know, it was one of those mixed games where there's some actors who had played baseball and then some, you know, legends like Bob Gibson. Joe Pepitone was there. Anyway, the corn was not that far away as it looks in the movie at that particular time. So, you know, I everybody was talking about who's going to be the first guy to hit one in the corn. And, you know, in the BP, I hit a few in there.
Ooh.
And so I was kind of feeling a little froggy. And I think Gibson didn't like it. So I'm digging in there. And the first pitch he throws is right at my dome. Like, and it's obviously he's 60 years old or whatever he is. It's not 100 miles an hour, but it was a pitch with purpose. And he knocked me down, and I thought, and that was just great. It was sort of like, man, you're not, don't dig in on me. I don't know, who do you think I am?
That's so much better than hitting one of the corn.
Yeah, and
that's
so great. Fitting too, man. It's so fitting.
And then he put up one finger next to his nose and let me know that he wasn't going to curve me, you know, and he threw me one right down the middle. And I got a single. So it was. It was an awesome moment. It was so cool that he did that.
That's the best of the Bob Gibson experience. Got a hit and almost got hit.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the things I like, I'm not a big, even though I'm a baseball guy and have been since I was a little kid, and I like baseball movies, but I don't love a lot of them because they bother me. But Eight Men Out's not one of those. That was one where, not just the movie, I'm talking about the baseball parts, right, where people go out there and do them. Some of them don't look good, but I thought, and even though that's not the main part of the movie, I thought that part still fit really well. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was real happy that I learned to hit lefty to do that movie, as I had been a right-handed hitting outfielder, and I just thought, here's a chance to get it right. Shoeless Joe is a lefty, and so I spent a long time getting it, you know, working on my swing. And they set up a shot where I hit a triple and there's no edits, which was really exciting to do. So they had, like, dolly tracks from home plate to third base, starts in a close-up at the plate. And then I had to hit it out into right center off the wall and then run the bases. So it's pretty fun to be able to have that shot in the movie because, you know, there's no trickeration and with no visual effects. I had to hit the ball in a certain area. The guy had to hit the cutoff, you know. So that was really fun. And, yeah, I'm really proud of that movie. Also, the baseball aspect. In baseball movies, it tends to either be the guy either hits a home run or strikes out.
Right.
There's really no subtlety to it, you know. So we have triples. We have double plays. We have a bunch of different kind of baseball plays that nobody had ever really done in a movie up till then.
Talking to DB Sweeney, I'm sure you guys know DB. He's going to take part in the cancer charity game Friday, April 5th. DB, tell us about your new project with Coppola.
Yeah, it's called Megalopolis, and Francis discovered me in the 80s and put me in a movie called Gardens of Stone, which launched my career opposite James Caan and Angelica Houston, and that was a huge boost to me. It really put me on the map, and now, you know, 36 years later, whatever it is, we shoot Megalopolis, which is the story that he's been trying to do for 30 years, and he eventually put up his own money, over $100 million, to make this movie last year. Wow. And it's really beautiful. It's really interesting. It's the most amazing cast ever. It's Aubrey Plaza, Adam Driver, John Voight, Dustin Hoffman, Shia LaBeouf, Giancarlo Esposito, Larry Fishburne. It's just a loaded all-star team, and it's really beautiful, and it's kind of a vision for the future. It's a very hopeful movie about like what cities could be and how people could get along better. And it's really cool. I mean, I haven't seen the finished movie yet, but I think it's going to be one of those ones that everybody wants to see.
I love it. I can't talk to D.B. Sweeney without asking about Fire in the Sky. So, I mean, you know, Wheels and I were nerds and we're paranormal nerds, and I love anything UFO or Bigfoot, what have you. This is a film. This is a great movie with great actors and a great script and the effects. Like, when you were making it, did you know we're making a really good film here?
Well, I thought the visual effects part of it was being done by Industrial Light and Magic, which is the state-of-the-art shop. You know, George Lucas set up that company just to do the effects for all his movies, and Spielberg used it and all these other. So I thought, yeah, this is the A-team here, and we have a chance to really make this, you know, something that nobody's really done before in terms of the believability of it. Because most UFO movies and so forth, they tend to be, up until then, it was sort of like, yeah, right, it's probably not true. It's probably, you know, not believable and so forth. So, yeah, I felt like when we were making it, we really had a chance to do something good. And Robert Patrick, you know, had just come off of doing Terminator 2, and he's such a good actor. And Peter Berg was in the movie before he became a filmmaker. And, you know, it was really a really good team. And, of course, James Garner, you know, was legendary. So you sort of have a sense that you have a chance when you got that kind of a team around you.
Yeah. Well, DB, a preemptive welcome to St. Louis. Have a great time. Wheels and I may be there. If so, we'll shake your hand, say hello.
Oh, I hope so.
All right, buddy. Thank you. That's DB Sweeney. Quick break, right back. DGS and KMOX. You got me all screwed up. So much I can't turn around. So I am not great at math, but I understand the basics of why there has never been nor will there ever be a perfect bracket.
Yeah.
But kind of walk through that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there are just so many variations, right? So there have been, like, I think,
quadrillion something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
Warren Buffett has put out the perfect bracket challenge in the past where it's like $1 million, or I don't know, it might have been more than that. It might have been $10 million if anybody can do it.
Yeah.
It is, because there are so many variations, it's impossible. It's never been done. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I'm sure that somebody in a church pool somewhere
right.
has had it, but I mean, like, nobody's ever won the big prize in any of those contests.
Yeah.
Because statistically, your odds of doing that are way lower than like winning a lottery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about D.B. Sweeney getting thrown at
Dude.
By Bob Gibson and then getting a hit off him?
Yeah.
God.
That's the best thing about doing, I mean, that's, he's doing a movie, you know, and
right.
being a part of, I guess you could say what the alumni games and
yeah.
things, those things, you just, it's so hard to describe how fun it is to be in those spots. Like, I got heckled by Whitey Herzog at Cardinals Fantasy Camp, and it was so great.
Yeah.
Lou Brock picked on me. It was, he's never mean, and it was great. It was like, oh, my God, I'm one of the guys.
What were they picking on you for?
Just being me.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes a lot of sense.
Short guy.
Yeah.
Stupid, not very good, you know, that kind of thing.
There's nothing about you that's picking on
no,
him.
No.
Did you make any good plays you're proud of?
I did all right. I mean, that's fine. I couldn't throw at the time, which is why I got made fun of, because I had an injured shoulder. So I'm like, throwing with my baby arm in a flashback
yeah,
of first
how I
hour.
Throw it normally.
Yeah, it was really, you know, that's what Lou was giving me a hard time about. Whitey was giving me a hard time, but because I was he was telling me I was being a tryhard, because you're not allowed to steal, and I was catching, right?
Right.
Well, ball bounces, I block it because I've got a whole life of doing that, and I teach it. Well, nobody can go anywhere. He's like, Mo doesn't have a contract for you, kid. I'm like, I'm sorry. But it was very tryhardy. I wasn't trying to be tryhard, but it was tryhardy.
Yeah. I believe you were
muscle
doing too
memory.
Much.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I stopped doing it because I got heckled, though.
Who's the best person you ever faced, like in real ball?
Probably, I didn't play enough in college to really get that experience. So probably my...
Josie's on a vacation far away. Come around and talk it over.
So welcome back, guys. DGS and Camo X coming up on Friday, April 5th, is the Puck Cancer Charity Game I told you about a few minutes ago. Our Blues alumni, featuring Barry Jackman, Pierre Turgeon, coached by Hully, will be taking on Chris Chelios, Ed Belfour, Dierks Bentley, D.B. Sweeney. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to a great foundation, Jimmy V Foundation for Siteman. Everyone's been touched by cancer at some point. D.B. Sweeney joins us now. D.B., it's a pleasure. You have a lot of fans in the room.
Oh, thanks, bud. Thanks for having me on.
Dude, you could have made Fire in the Sky and stopped, and we'd be super excited to talk to you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
It has to be like we're geeked out to talk to D.B. Sweeney, the actor we've watched over the decades. You got to be geeked out when you put the blades on and go out with these guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just anybody who's had a beer with Brett Hull knows that that's a bucket list item. So, I don't know if it's ever been singular.
No one has ever had a beer with, no, you're right. Let me introduce my buddy Kevin Wheeler. He's the 25-year sports guy here in St. Louis. Go ahead, Kevin.
We were just joking, DB, that part of the deal, if people want to do it for $500, they can get into the VIP event, which means you could have some food and some beers with Kelly Chase and with Brett Hull and guys like you, which is also kind of the fun part. And talk a bit about that. You know, having covered sports forever, all the sports guys love musicians, they love actors, they all want to be that. And I'm guessing it goes the other way, too.
Yeah, well, you know, when I did The Cutting Edge, 30 years ago now, I guess even a little more than that, I was living in New York, and I grew up a Ranger fan, and I had been skating for about 6 weeks, learning to skate from scratch, and the Rangers put me on their old-timers. They still call them old-timers, not alumni at that point. And so they put me on their team, and I, like I said, skating for 6 weeks, and I played in a game against the Islanders old-timers in front of 3,000 people. And Pierre LaRouche said, keep your stick on the ice and go to the net. And I thought, that sounds like good advice. I don't know what I'm doing. And I scored 2 goals on deflections. And I thought, wow, I'm pretty good at this. And then in the locker room after, Pierre LaRouche is collecting money from all the Rangers. He bet the whole team he could score 2 goals off my stick.
So they just set you up nicely.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so anyway, it's just an illustration of like how the hockey world just embraced me because of that movie. And, I have so many friends. And so, to hear Kelly dealing with this and Tony Granato, it just seems like an easy thing to bring all the forces together and try to attack this problem.
Yeah, it's fascinating, too. I mean, they a lot of these alumni groups do great work. I've never been around one, though, DB, that does more for the community and more regularly for the community than the Blues. I mean, these guys, a lot of them still live here in town. Brett Hull obviously still works for the team. Chaser's been around forever, and obviously he's going through his fight with leukemia right now. And we all love those guys. And I'm guessing that when you guys get the call to do things like this, it's an easy yes, right? I mean, it's fun. It's a great cause. And obviously, you get to have them score goals off your stick.
Yeah, I mean, it's very serious what Kelly's dealing with and with Tony Granato and all the other people that are suffering with the various different cancers that we're trying to attack. But, this is such a great group of guys that it'll be fun. And hopefully we raise a lot of money and awareness.
So walking through it a little bit, I mean, people, you mentioned Cutting Edge. I know a lot of people, Rachel's not here today. She's out sick. But when we mentioned you were coming on, that was the first movie she went to. Dave and I looked at each other and it was, it was the Fire in the Sky because we're both big UFO guys. But I'm the baseball nerd in the room. And obviously you were Shoeless Joe in Eight Men Out. You mentioned coming up as a Rangers guy. Was hockey always a favorite sport for you? Were you more baseball, more football, or you just kind of anything goes?
I'm a big sports fan in all areas, but definitely baseball was my number one. That was what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to go play for the Red Sox. I'm from Long Island, which is where Kari Stremski's from. He was my favorite player.
Oh,
But I've always been a baseball, fan first, but hockey second, and never played as a kid. So doing that movie was a great opportunity to learn.
DB, how did you get into acting? I'm always fascinated how jocks get into acting.
I was a senior in high school, and the theater teacher was also the English teacher, and I was a wise ass, and he sort of dared me to take my act up on stage, and he dared me in front of the whole class, so I couldn't say no, and I just did that play, and it was a great experience, but it was not like any kind of a thing I thought about doing again. And then when I got hurt in college, I went to Tulane University to try and play baseball down there. And I got injured and started thinking, well, maybe I'll check out acting again while I rehab.
Nice. I should have known. I should have known you're a good guy. I was a college baseball guy myself too, so I figured you were pretty smart by going that route. So, when you get the opportunity to do these, and I, you know, we're going to talk about a couple things because I know you're in a really big movie that's coming out here soon, Francis Ford Coppola movie, Megalopolis. But when you get out there and have to and get to hang with these guys, what is the best part? Just the pre and the post. You know, like for as an example, I got to do the Cardinals fantasy camp, the Legends camp, and the best part is the in between games. The best part is hanging out in the clubhouse or going out to dinner with the guys and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my theory. My son played hockey for many years. He's 22 now. He's in college, but from the time he was very little, he went through that whole travel hockey experience.
Oh, okay.
We came down to St. Louis and. And my theory about why hockey players are such good guys is because of all that time in the room. Like, it takes 30 minutes to get your stuff on and hang out and 20 minutes to get it off. Whereas playing baseball, you know, you grab your spikes, you grab your glove. It's kind of like being a tennis player. It's you against the pitcher. There's not really a lot of teamwork in baseball. It's pretty much an individual sport,
yep,
masquerading as a team sport. And except unless you're a shortstop or a second baseman or a catcher, I guess. And but anyway, so in hockey, what I was able to observe is that it's a very, you know, self-policing world. Like, you really can't be a jagoff and survive many rooms. So
true.
I think it's kind of fascinating that culture is so positive in creating good guys.
So, DB, we're real close to the same age. I'll be 60 in September, and I grew up here, grew up a Cardinals fan, but I was also, like, I knew every player on the Reds. I knew every player on the A's. What did St. Louis mean to you growing up as a Rangers and a Red Sox fan?
Well, I mean, growing up, I wasn't as aware of the Blues as I am now, or as I was, you know, from the 80s, 90s, and so forth forward. But the St. Louis Cardinals was just excellence. You know, I mean, they beat my Red Sox in 67, and they won again in 68, and or did the Tigers win in 68? Either way, they went to the World Series two times. But I got to, when they first had the Field of Dreams field built after that movie was made, I got to play in a game there, and I got to hit off of Bob Gibson, which was a huge thrill. And it was amazing. And so, you know, it was one of those mixed games where there's some actors who had played baseball and then some, you know, legends like Bob Gibson. Joe Pepitone was there. Anyway, the corn was not that far away as it looks in the movie at that particular time. So, you know, everybody was talking about who's going to be the first guy to hit one in the corn. And, you know, in the BP, I hit a few in there.
Ooh.
And so I was kind of feeling a little froggy. And I think Gibson didn't like it. So I'm digging in there. And the first pitch he throws is right at my dome. Like, and it's obviously he's 60 years old or whatever he is. It's not 100 miles an hour, but it was a pitch with purpose. And he knocked me down. And I thought, and that was just great. It was sort of like, man, you're not, don't dig in on me. I don't know, who do you think I am?
That's so much better than hitting one in the corner.
Yeah, and it's so fitting too, man. It's so fitting.
And then he put up one finger next to his nose and let me know that he wasn't going to curve me, you know, and he threw me one right down the middle. And I got a single. So it was an awesome moment. It was so cool that he did that.
That's the best of the Bob Gibson experience. Got a hit and almost got hit.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the things I like, I'm not a big, even though I'm a baseball guy and have been since I was a little kid, and I like baseball movies, but I don't love a lot of them. Because they bother me, but Eight Men Out's not one of those. That was one where, not just the movie, I'm talking about the baseball parts, right, where people go out there and do them. Some of them don't look good, but I thought, and even though that's not the main part of the movie, I thought that part still fit really well. That was fun.
Yeah,
I was real happy that I learned to hit lefty to do that movie, as I had been a right-handed hitting outfielder, and I just thought, here's a chance to get it right. Shoeless Joe is a lefty, and so I spent a long time getting it, you know, working on my swing. And they set up a shot where I hit a triple and there's no edits, which was really exciting to do. So they had like dolly tracks from home plate to third base, starts in a close-up at the plate. And then I had to hit it out into right center off the wall and then run the bases. So it's pretty fun to be able to have that shot in the movie because, you know, there's no trickeration and with no visual effects. I had to hit the ball in a certain area. The guy had to hit the cutoff, you know. So that was really fun. And, yeah, I'm really proud of that movie. Also, the baseball aspect. In baseball movies, it tends to either be the guy either hits a home run or strikes out.
Right.
There's really no subtlety to it, you know. So we have triples, we have double plays, we have a bunch of different kind of baseball plays that nobody had ever really done in a movie up till then.
talking to D.B. Sweeney. I'm sure you guys know D.B. He's going to take part in the cancer charity game Friday, April 5th. D.B., tell us about your new project with Coppola.
Yeah, it's called Megalopolis, and Francis discovered me in the 80s and put me in a movie called Gardens of Stone, which launched my career opposite James Caan and Angelica Houston, and that was a huge boost to me. It really put me on the map, and now, you know, 36 years later, whatever it is, we shoot Megalopolis, which is the story that he's been trying to do for 30 years, and he eventually put up his own money, over $100 million, to make this movie last year. Wow. And it's really beautiful. It's really interesting. It's the most amazing cast ever. It's Aubrey Plaza, Adam Driver, John Voight, Dustin Hoffman, Shia LaBeouf, Giancarlo Esposito, Larry Fishburne. It's just a loaded all-star team, and it's really beautiful, and it's kind of a vision for the future. It's a very hopeful movie about like what cities could be and how people could get along better. And it's really cool. I mean, I haven't seen the finished movie yet, but I think it's going to be one of those ones that everybody wants to see.
I love it. I can't talk to D.B. Sweeney without asking about Fire in the Sky. So, I mean, you know, Wheels and I were nerds and we're paranormal nerds, and I love anything UFO or Bigfoot, what have you. This is a film. This is a great movie with great actors and a great script and the effects. Like, when you were making it, did you know we're making a really good film here?
Well, I thought the visual effects part of it was being done by Industrial Light and Magic, which is the, you know, the state-of-the-art shop. You know, George Lucas set up that company just to do the effects for all his movies, and Spielberg used it and all these others. So I thought, yeah, this is the A-team here, and we have a chance to really make this, you know, something that nobody's really done before in terms of the believability of it. Because most UFO movies and so forth, they tend to be, up until then, it was sort of like, yeah, right, it's probably not true. It's probably, you know, not believable and so forth. So, yeah, I felt like when we were making it, we really had a chance to do something good. And Robert Patrick, you know, had just come off of doing Terminator 2, and you know, he's such a good actor. And Peter Berg was in the movie before he became a filmmaker. And, you know, it was really a really good team. And, of course, James Garner, you know, was legendary. So you sort of have a sense that you have a chance when you got that kind of a team around you.
Yeah. Well, DB, a preemptive welcome to St. Louis. Have a great time. Wheels and I may be there. If so, we'll shake your hand, say hello.
Oh, I hope so.
All right, buddy. Thank you. That's DB Sweeney. Quick break. Right back. DGS and KMOX. You got me all screwed up. So much I can't turn around. So I am not great at math, but I understand the basics of why there has never been nor will there ever be a perfect bracket.
Yeah.
But kind of walk through that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there are just so many variations, right? So there have been, I think,
quadrillion or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Warren Buffett has put out the perfect bracket challenge in the past where it's like $1 million, or I don't know, it might have been even more than that. It might have been $10 million if anybody can do it.
Yeah.
It is, because there are so many variations, it's impossible. It's never been done. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I'm sure that somebody in a
we'll claim it
in a church pool somewhere has had it, but I mean, like, nobody's ever won the big prize in any of those contests.
Yeah.
Because statistically, your odds of doing that are way lower than like winning a lottery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about D.B. Sweeney getting thrown at
Dude.
By Bob Gibson and then getting a hit off him?
Yeah.
God.
That's the best thing about doing, I mean, that's he's doing a movie, you know, and right. being a part of, I guess you could say what the alumni games and
yeah.
things, those things, you just, it's so hard to describe how fun it is to be in those spots. Like, I got heckled by Whitey Herzog at Cardinals Fantasy Camp, and it was so great.
Yeah.
It's like, Lou Brock picked on me. It was, he's never mean, and it was great. It was like, oh, my God, I'm one of the guys.
What were they picking on you for?
Just being me.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes a lot of sense.
Short guy.
Yeah.
Stupid, not very good, you know, that kind of thing.
There's nothing about you that's pick on.
No.
Did you make any good plays you're proud of?
I did all right. I mean, I was fine. I couldn't throw at the time, which is why I got made fun of because I had an injured shoulder. So I'm like, throwing with my baby arm in a flashback
that's
of first
how I
hour.
Throw normally.
Yeah, it was really, you know, that's what Lou was giving me a hard time about. Whitey was giving me a hard time, but because I was he was telling me I was being a tryhard. Because you're not allowed to steal, and I was catching, right?
Right.
Well, ball bounces. I block it because I've got a whole life of doing that, and I teach it. Well, nobody can go anywhere. He's like, Mo doesn't have a contract for you, kid. I'm like, I'm sorry. But it was very try-hardy. I wasn't trying to be try-hard, but it was try-hardy.
Yeah. I believe you were
muscle
doing too
memory.
Much.
No. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I stopped doing it because I got heckled, though.
Who's the best person you ever faced?
like in real ball?
Probably. You know, I didn't play enough in college to really get that experience, so probably my teammates. So
that's fair.
The best guy was probably my teammate named Danny Graves, who closed for the Reds and the Indians for a long time. He's in the Reds Hall of Fame, and he's one of the better relievers they've ever had.
And even at your level, was it just impossible to hit?
I mean, no, you'd hit them in practice and stuff in games in that setting because you know those guys. But like, yeah, when you're you see how good those guys are, and you're like, how does anybody hit it? And then people do. Well, that's the guys that get paid.
There you go. You got me all screwed up. So much I can't turn around. So I am not great at math, but I understand the basics of why there has never been nor will there ever be a perfect bracket.
Yeah.
But kind of walk through that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there are just so many variations, right? So there have been, like, I think...
A quadrillion or something like that.
Warren Buffett has put out the perfect bracket challenge in the past where it's like $1 million or, I don't know, it might have been even more than that. It might have been $10 million if anybody can do it.
Yeah.
It is, because there are so many variations, it's impossible. It's never been done. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I'm sure that somebody in a
we'll claim it
in a church pool somewhere right. had it, but I mean, like, nobody's ever won the big prize in any of those contests.
Yeah.
Because statistically, your odds of doing that are way lower than, like, winning a lottery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about D.B. Sweeney getting thrown at
Dude.
By Bob Gibson and then getting a hit off him?
Yeah.
God.
That's the best thing about doing, I mean, that's he's doing a movie, you know, and right. being a part of, you know, the I guess you could say what the alumni games and
yeah.
things. Those things, you just, it's so hard to describe how fun it is to be in those spots. Like, I got heckled by Whitey Herzog at Cardinals Fantasy Camp, and it was so great.
Yeah.
It's like, Lou Brock picked on me. He's never mean, and it was great. It was like, oh, my God, I'm one of the guys.
What were they picking on you for?
Just being me.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes a lot of sense.
Short guy.
Yeah.
Stupid, not very good, you know, that kind of thing.
There's nothing about you that's picking on
him. No.
Did you make any good plays you're proud of?
I did all right. I mean, I was fine. I couldn't throw at the time, which is why I got made fun of, because I had an injured shoulder. So I'm like, throwing with my baby arm in a flashback
that's
the first
how I
hour.
Throw normally.
Yeah, it was really, you know, that's what Lou was giving me a hard time about. Whitey was giving me a hard time, but because I was he was telling me I was being a tryhard because you're not allowed to steal, and I was catching right. Well, ball bounces, I block it because I've got a whole life of doing that, and I teach it. Well, nobody can go anywhere. He's like, Mo doesn't have a contract for you, kid. I'm like, I'm sorry. But it was very tryhardy. I wasn't trying to be tryhard, but it was tryhardy.
I believe you were
muscle
doing too
memory.
Much.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I stopped doing it because I got heckled though.
Who's the best person you ever faced, like in real ball?
Probably, you know, I didn't play enough in college to really get that experience, so probably my teammates. So
that's fair.
The best guy was probably my teammate named Danny Graves, who closed for the Reds and the Indians for a long time. He's in the Reds Hall of Fame, and he's one of the better relievers they've ever had.
And even at your level, was it just impossible to hit?
I mean, no, you'd hit them in practice and stuff in games in that setting because you know those guys. But like, yeah, when you're, you see how good those guys are and you're like, how does anybody hit it? And then people do. Well, that's the guys that get paid.
There you go.